This is a global production.
I was in the kitchen in my house in Ruislip, and my mother called out to me and said to me, it's all over. I said, so what do you mean? And she goes, we've lost Daddy. And I said, what do you mean, lost Daddy? What do you mean? He says, well, Daddy's dead. And I was having a Mr. Kipling Bakewell tart at the time, and I'll never forget it. And the Bakewell tart, it just fell to the floor, and life would never be the same again. And I said, I explained this on air, and we just had the richest conversation, I think, you know, I can remember.
But it's things like that that make the audience relate to you as a presenter.
100%.
Hello and welcome to another edition of the Ian Dale All Talk podcast. I'm Ian Dale. Now, if you have been listening to the podcast regularly, and there are over 370 episodes for you to listen to, you'll know that I like to interview some of my colleagues at LBC from time to time. And I was thinking the other day that I haven't interviewed Ali Mirage. So we're going to put that right today. Ali presents the Saturday and Sunday lunchtime afternoon shows between 12 and 3. And Ali, welcome, first of all. You've been on the station for quite some time now, haven't you?
I have. And Ian, look, it's a great pleasure. I'm a big fan of yours, as you know, for many, many years. Yeah, it has been a while. Friday the 23rd, 2022, is when this adventure journey, call it
what you will, it was way before that.
It feels like way before that. But that's when it began. And I will never forget that day because there's normally a kids' Christmas party at the bank I was working in at the time. And my nieces and nephews had come to the bank and they'd done their thing and gone off at about 12:30.
What, in July?
No. This was in December. In December, just before Christmas. And so they'd gone home. And I was meant to go home and think about, you know, the show and this and that, and whatever. I was on at 1 till 4 a.m. that night. And I never really got home because I started doing this encyclopedia, writing all these different topics about the NHS or employment or police or this. I don't know why, just like some encyclopedia. And I called a friend of mine at about 5 o'clock and I thought, you know what? I don't think I'm going to get home tonight. I'm going to go straight to the studio for my show at 1 a.m. from here because I honestly don't have a clue what I'm doing. And then I came to the studio. I had a producer at the time, Freddie, and we were just like, everything I prepared was just
Freddie,
like,
Freddie with the loud voice.
Indeed.
Freddie sits opposite me quite a lot of the time.
He's a great guy.
He is a great guy, but oh my God, he's got a loud voice.
He does. Great guy, though. And everything I'd prepared, Ian, went out the window. We looked at a few stories, and you know how it works. Looked at a few stories, topical things. And then we came up with the first question for the first hour was, it was, you know, the Christmas getaway. Everyone was like, chaos as ever. Mm. Said, is Britain a failed state? I thought, this is going to be good.
And, I mean, I've never presented the overnight slot, apart from if I'm doing general election nights or such things like that. But there's always been a part of me that thought that was actually the slot that my voice is most suited to because it sends people to sleep. But, I mean, the challenges of overnights are very different to the daytime. I mean, you can't get the number of calls overnight that a daytime presenter would get because obviously the audience is much more limited.
It is. It's very different. And I remember that first time I did that 1 till 4 a.m. slot, and it was 2 days before Christmas. It was very funny because you know that the callers, Ian, are the stars of LBC, right? And I remember doing that. I didn't even know how the cough button worked, right? So I was coughing. I'm thinking, what does this button do? And then I remember some of the callers calling and saying, Ali, I think you're doing rather well. I thought this is quite civilised.
But isn't that weird? Because I had a similar experience to you on my first show where I didn't realise that you could only take calls that were in the two boxes at the bottom of the screen. So I was going to Dave in Walthamstow in the first box and wondered why Dave wasn't there.
Absolutely, absolutely. But no, but the interesting point you make, and I agree, is that after doing that, I started doing Saturdays and Sundays from 4 till 7 a.m. for about, I don't know, 11 months. And this thing nearly killed me. I mean, it really did. Yeah. I mean, I was working in the city 5 days a week. And then you think about it conceptually and you think, OK, I'm going to bed on Friday night at 10:30, getting up at 1:30 in the morning, catching the night tube here to Leicester Square. And you know what's going on at 1:30 in the morning on a Saturday, Ian? You're jumping over piles of vomit or whatever, right? And you get in and you do your show. But the thing is, I've always believed
That's just in the newsroom.
I've always believed that in any field of human endeavour, you've got to do your apprenticeship, right? Whatever it is, be it politics, be it... You would not appoint a first-year medical student to perform open-heart surgery. You would not appoint a first-year graduate to be a CEO of an investment bank. In the same way, you're not going to get loose on primetime radio unless you've learnt your craft, right? So I think it's very important to do that. And you're right, at that time in the morning, you have no one to interview, unless you're interviewing someone in the US or something. There's no one to interview. You've got yourself and you've got your callers. But the interesting thing is that you, if you come up with the right topics in the right way, you can really form a bond and a rapport with your callers. And I'll never forget, there was one time when my producer on a Friday night had sent me some ideas and thoughts. We're exchanging ideas of what we're going to do on the show. And he sent me something about Alex Ferguson's wife had died. Why has he sent me this? And so I said, why have you sent me this? He goes, well, I thought we could do like an hour on grief. I go, well, that's cheery. And we did this hour. We started this hour on grief at 5 a.m., Ian. And we just went on for 2 hours. And people were calling in. And the board was full. Absolutely full.
Yeah. And that is a brilliant subject to do. I've never done an hour on grief that hasn't worked.
It was
because everybody's got their own very personal stories.
Very personal. And it was... And look, you know, I don't tend to open up that much about my own life necessarily on air because it's not all about you. But I do think that...
You see, that's where I disagree with you.
You see, on an hour like that...
I think it is about you.
I mean, I understand the point you're making. I think that, look, I give my opinions a lot on, very stridently, as you know, when I'm doing my shows. But on things like that, I think you have to give a bit to get a lot back. And on that, you know, it was the first time ever on... National Radio, I talked about the loss of my own father, which happened 5 days before my 11th birthday. I'd never spoken about it before. And I think, and it, you know, obviously it's a pivotal moment in my life. I mean, it is what it is, you know. I mean, I'll never forget the time that call came. We were going back to Pakistan at the time. We were born and bred in the UK. My parents had come here, met in London, got married in London, were introduced by a friend. My father was an engineer. My mother was a doctor, professional people. And my mother's mother, my grandma, was very unwell. So my dad had gone back to look after her and was setting things up and wanted, we were going to, you know, all go relocate there. And I will never forget it. I was in the kitchen in my house in Ruislip and my mother called out to me and said to me, it's all over. And I said, so what do you mean? And she goes, we've lost Daddy. And I said, what do you mean, lost Daddy? What do you mean? He says, well, Daddy's dead. And I was having a Mr. Kipling Bakewell tart at the time, and I'll never forget it. And the Bakewell tart, it just fell to the floor. And life would never be the same again. And I said, I explained this on air, and we just had the richest conversation, I think, you know, I can remember.
But it's things like that that make the audience relate to you as a presenter.
100%, 100%.
I mean, my partner always complains that I keep... constantly says, can you keep nothing private? And I said, well, obviously there are things I keep private, but I'm an open book. And I think particularly when you're doing... over most of my time on LBC, well, for 12 out of the 17 years, I've been doing the evening show.
Yeah.
And you can do things later in the evening, in the 9 to 10 hour, that you can't do during the day.
Absolutely.
And you can do things at 4 o'clock in the morning that you can't do at 9 o'clock in the evening. And I just think that subjects like that, they connect you to an audience in a way that no TV presenter can ever understand.
There's an intimacy.
Yeah.
And you know, the interesting thing is also, Ian, we're sitting in the studio at LBC, which is not the regular studio which we broadcast from in the week. And this is a very intimate studio. I mean, you literally feel it in the early hours of the morning that it's you and your callers and no one else. There are no guests to interview. There's no noise. It's just you and the callers. And I always used to be told by my producers, don't worry, Ellie, if it's quiet, you can always, you know, look at the papers and give your view on the papers. I never once in my entire time doing the 4 till 7 a.m. slot ever had to talk to the papers. Because if you find the right tone, you find the right topics, you open up a little bit, and the pace is slightly different, you can really find a connection with your audience.
Did you, in your early days, ever panic when there weren't any calls?
Look, there is that bit of anxiety there, and I think that that's quite natural, because you think, OK, there are no calls. What are you going to do? And we call it churning, right? So you, I always say, look, guys, give me a few bits and pieces that I can talk to. Give me a few things. And I'm normally quite diligent when I think about my shows and prepare for my shows. So I always have material to think about and talk about. And I also like to go a little bit deeper. I think the part of the job as a broadcaster is to educate the audience, but educate myself as well. So we're trying to open up conversations on some quite difficult, challenging areas and issues where there is no simple answer. So we're looking for people to actually think about stuff that people have found difficult to find the answer to, right? If it was that easy to go and solve the not in education, employment or training problem, it would have been done. Mm. If it was that easy to solve, you know, the demographic challenges we face of an aging population or the challenges posed by potentially AI, it would have been done. So all of this stuff. And I say to people, you know, let's open up the space, not just to have a moan fest, because that doesn't get us anywhere. Like, fair enough. We can all grumble a bit. That's fine. I do too. But let's try and move the conversation on to what would you do? What would you recommend? How do we actually improve this so that our society and our country is better? And those are the kind of conversations where you actually push each other. And I get pushed as a presenter by my audience, who are, I tell you, the great British public have got fantastic ideas, perspectives, life experience, knowledge, that I think that we... This is such a unique platform that we have to open up those conversations. Nothing else like this exists, really, apart from if you go into the online world, which is a complete Wild West cesspit. I mean, where else do you have the opportunity to invite people into a conversation on some really difficult, challenging stuff where we're pushing each other and we're all learning?
Let's go back to that moment when you found out that your father had died. You were 11 years old. And that was really, I mean, I suppose in many ways, a key moment, a sliding doors moment, because if he hadn't died, you then were going to relocate to Pakistan.
That's right.
And who knows what you would be doing now.
Absolutely.
You must have thought about that quite a lot.
I have thought about it, because even in the run-up to that, Ian, I mean, that happened in October, just 5 days before my 11th birthday. My birthday is on the 31st of October. I'm a Halloween baby. That probably explains quite a lot. And I was actually named after... And this is a true story, and I've said it before. I was actually named after Muhammad Ali because my aunt was a huge fan of the boxer. Some people think I was named after the founder of Pakistan, Muhammad Ali Jinnah. That's not true. I was named after the boxer, Muhammad Ali, because on the 30th of October, 1974, in Zaire, he had the rumble in the jungle where he beat George Foreman. And my aunt said to my mother, if he wins the match, we're going to name him Muhammad Ali. If he loses, you can name him what you want. And he did win, and that was the rest of it. That's a story. But it was a sliding doors moment. Because
why are you Ali, not Muhammad?
Well, people at school used to call me Mo, which is a bit of a bastardized version of your name, right? So, they used to call me Mo, but at home, everyone called me Ali. And that's quite common because Muhammad is a very common name amongst Muslims out there. So often you will have your middle name is what people will use. So I thought it'd be easier when I was at university. A lot of people there from
Mo Pakistan Mirage, partners. Though that has a ring to it.
Yeah, but that's what my school friends still call me. They still call me Mo. They still call me Mo Mirage now. So that's the story. But yes, it was a sliding doors moment in the sense that in the run up to that period, we had spent a bit of time in Pakistan before, and I'd actually got enrolled in a school for a few months and was there and was adjusting to that. Then we came back to London, and then we were going to go back for the final big move. And I remember my grandmother. Her biggest concern used to be every day asking the cook to inspect what I had in my tiffin carrier before I went to school, right? So it was quite sweet. But when my father passed away, that was a big moment because, look, my mother was a doctor, NHS doctor for 40 years. At that time, you know, my sister was 3. I was just before my 11th birthday. She went back and she had a big decision to make. Do you go back to Pakistan with 2 young kids where you've been out of the country for quite a while? And my parents came from very affluent backgrounds, right? My grandfather on the maternal side was the first commissioner of Karachi, education secretary. My paternal grandfather was the commissioner of the Forestry Commission in Punjab. So they were well-to-do people. But when you've been out of the loop for 20 years, right? And it's still a society where it's, in many cases, not what you know, but who you know. And all your family are busy with their own lives. Okay, when they're there for the funeral, fine. But they're going to go back to their... Of course they are. So she had to make a decision that, look, I'm now a young woman with 2 young kids. What do I do? I don't have any job. I don't have any secure job there. I've got an NHS job here. What do I do? So she had to make a really, really tragic decision for herself, which was to say to her mother, look, Mum, I'm so sorry. I can't come and look after you. I have to stay in London. And that was a big moment. And then the second moment that happened when she made that decision was that when we came back after the funeral and everything else, all my friends were going for common entrance exams at the time. And I said to my mother, look, my friends are going for exams and things, and I want to do that. And she said, are you sure? Do you really want to do this now? I mean, why do you want the pressure? You've just lost your dad. I said, look, no, I really want to go for these common entrance exams. So she had to call the schools. We'd missed all the deadlines. She pleaded with them to let me in. And I applied to three schools, John Lyon, Merchant Taylors and Haberdashers, and managed to get into both Merchant Taylors and Haberdashers, and chose Haberdashers, which was a school that Sacha Baron Cohen went to and Matt Lucas. I didn't turn into a comedian, but some people might think I am a comedian on my shows. I don't know. But that school then played a massive part in my life. So that was a big, big pivotal moment. But the pressure for that came from me. It didn't come from my mum or my family. It came from me. And I was very lucky at the time that my first cousin happened to be on a sabbatical in London. And she helped me cram like a crazy person to get through these exams, which were bloody difficult, actually.
All right, resistance up. Let's climb.
Okay, here we go.
Oh, my knee's playing up again.
Have you ever had it looked at?
No, but I've been doing a few stretches.
When my shoulder went, Benenden Health got me expert help. Showed me exactly where I was going wrong.
30 seconds, people.
Don't let niggles slow your stride. Access physiotherapy and much more for less than £16 per person per month. Search Benenden Health.
Fee review periodically. T's and C's apply. Qualifying periods apply for some services, including physio. UK only. Visit benenden.co.uk.
How? So you've never actually lived in Pakistan?
No, but I know
not for any length of time.
No, but I know the country very well. Have a deep affection for it.
How much affinity do you have for it? Because I mean, I think it's first or second generation immigrants have fascinating stories here. And I was watching, I mean, I should say we're recording this in the middle of the World Cup. And I saw an Instagram reel this morning with this Jamaican guy who was going on about sort of the fact that he was English and he felt great affinity to England. Yeah. And he was very much a sort of Cockney geezer guy.
Yeah.
And he said, why shouldn't I support the country that I was born in and that I lived in? And yet I'm somehow told that I should be ashamed to be supporting England.
Yeah.
He said, I love Jamaica. And if Jamaica plays a football match, I'm going to support Jamaica. But if Jamaica play England, fuck Jamaica. And I thought, mate, you've got it.
No, exactly. Well, I feel similarly. And it's interesting because I remember the very famous Norman Tebbit cricket test, right? And I remember actually being at school in 1992, and you'll remember the World Cup when Pakistan faced England in the World Cup, and it was when Waseem Akram and Waqar Yunus were in their heyday, and Imran Khan was in his later years as a player, but it was the pinnacle of his career, and they won. And I remember embracing my friends at school who were wearing the Pakistan T-shirt at the time. And then a few years hence, I thought to myself, why on earth was I cheering on Pakistan at the time? I am born in England, I'm British, I should jolly well be supporting England, right? And that was, a moment which I reflected on. And I thought, well, no, this is the country that has nurtured me. This is the country where I live. This is the country that has given me all the opportunities I have. And I say that not because I would have not had a very salubrious lifestyle in Pakistan. I would. But, you know, this is the country I belong to. So, yes, I do get it. Yes, I have an affinity with Pakistan. I have a lot of friends and family there. I have a lot of friends from university who studied with me at a university at the London School of Economics, who are basically either the sons of aristocrats or industrialists. And their idea of having a weekend off was to go and blow a lot of money at the Dorchester Club gambling. So it wasn't exactly a normal kind of student life for a lot of these guys. But there are a lot of friends of mine there. I have a lot of affinity. But yes, I care deeply about England, about Britain, and I consider myself to be 100% British and indeed English, not in some sort of sense of ethnicity, if you like. But I mean, look, we're living in a devolution world. And, you know, if the Scots and the Welsh want to, you know, play up on their independence, I think I should play upon my fact that I'm in England and I'm born in England and I love my country.
Have you ever felt an outsider, though?
The only time, Ian, it's an interesting question. The only time it's really, I felt like a, hang on a second, what's going on here, was when I was actually, I'd fought a couple of seats for Parliament, as you know, for the Conservative Party. And I came to a point where I'd done my no hope seat in Wales where, you know, managed to keep my deposit and beat a guy who was standing against me, handing out baked beans to voters wearing a cape called Captain Beanie. I mean, that was quite lucky that I beat him, thankfully. And then I fought my marginal seat in Watford, where I narrowly lost it in 2005. And then I was going for safe seats, what we call safe seats, right, which mean, you know, big Tory majority. And then I was told by a few MPs and also by the head of candidates at the time, look, Ali, you're a great guy, but, you know, you're not going to get X seat because you're not a white middle-class male. And I thought to myself, hang on a second, right? So we've got David Cameron talking about modernising the party, right? I'm one of your highest profile candidates, and you're telling me that this is basically a fait accompli and that you're a good guy, but you're not going to get anywhere. And I'm thinking, hang on a second. I've been to one of the best schools in the country. I've been to one of the best universities in the world, actually two of them, the LSE and Harvard. I've been very lucky in many ways. And you're telling me now that in the Tory party, I'm going to have to face this kind of nonsense. I mean, this isn't cricket. So that's the only time, and knowing me, Ian, I didn't keep quiet about it. I wrote a blog about it, and all hell broke loose.
But, well, I vaguely remember this, because weren't you... I don't know whether you actually applied or were put off applying for Witham.
No, I applied for Witham, and I was told...
So did I.
Right. And I was told by not just the head of candidates at the time, but another couple of MPs in the surrounding area, that they all said the same thing. Look, you're not going to get it because you're not a white middle-class male, which I just thought was odd. I mean, they weren't being nasty or malicious or racist in any way. They weren't. All they were doing was telling me the truth as they saw it to try and equip me. Mm. They weren't being nasty. But I just felt, look, you know.
And then Priti Patel won it.
Priti Patel won it on the back of the whole Ferrari that happened, right? I mean, not casting a thing about, you know, that she wouldn't have won it
but she won it? Because she promised to reintroduce capital punishment. That was why she won it.
Exactly. So, if you look at it now, look how far the Tory party's come. I mean, it's fantastic, right? We've got Kemi Badenoch there now. We had Rishi Sunak. So I think the Tory party has come a long, long way from those days. But that's when I faced it. And I never really dwell on it. And I never really thought about it until that point because I'd never had to face it. And I haven't really had to face it since, quite honestly.
So you had a bit of a falling out with David Cameron.
I did. Look, I was close to David Cameron. I respected him highly. I spoke at the launch of his leadership campaign at the time when you were backing David Davis, Ian, only because I thought that he was the right man for the job at the right time. And he's got great skills. He's a great orator. He can tell a story. He speaks well. He looks the part. All of that stuff is good. And at the time, the Tory party was in the doldrums. I mean, 2005, we'd had another disastrous election defeat. We needed something new, and he was it. And I thought he was the right guy. I did it in fast forward with David Cameron because I was taken in, and then I just thought that there was nothing much behind the curtain, to be honest. And, yeah, we did have a falling out, basically because I thought he was full of style and no substance. And then, yeah, it just, you know, it is what it is. That blew up my career, my political career. And, you know, in one way you could say it's sad. In another way you could say, well, actually, I prevented myself from being in Parliament voting for interventions in Libya, Syria, and then eventually for a referendum which led to the withdrawal from the EU on the back of a cack-handed renegotiation with Europe that was never going to succeed. But there we are.
You'd still have loved to have done it, though, wouldn't you? Because once you get the political virus, it's very difficult to get rid of it.
Ian, the reason I went into politics was because I wanted to effect change in this country, and I thought I could actually help with the governance of it. That was a genuine thing. So the reason I got involved in politics, and I became a councillor when I was 23 years old on the back of Labour's landslide in 1997. I just thought, oh gosh, what the hell is going to go on with the country now? So that's why I got involved. And look, who knows what might have been, right? I think I could have done a pretty decent job. I've got some good skills. I know quite a lot about finance, foreign affairs, various things. But it is what it is. And everything happens for a reason. And I take my hat off to politicians because Most of them, I believe, are trying to do the right thing, right? I mean, you don't get paid much in this thing. You get a lot of abuse, more abuse now than you've ever got before because of social media. People think they own you. Your own party's trying to stab you in the back. The opposition's trying to trip you up. Someone in Parliament's trying to have an affair with you. I mean, it's not an easy thing to do, to be a politician. So, look, who knows what might have been. I think I would have done a pretty decent job. But I'm really enjoying broadcasting, and I think that that is a different way to actually try and have a voice in the conversation and try and make a difference.
But you're only 51. You could still do it.
Ian, you know, when I reflect on this now, and look, you never say never, right? I mean, look at David Miliband. He might make a comeback. I don't know. Ed Balls might make a comeback. Who knows? Andy Burnham's making a comeback. I don't know. Look, I do feel very passionate about this country, and I also feel very concerned about a number of issues. Very concerned. I feel very concerned about the polarization in our society at a visceral, deep level, right? So let me give you an example. If I look at rising anti-Muslimism, and I don't use the term Islamophobia because a phobia implies an irrational fear of things, right? And I don't think when you've had multiple terrorist attacks that have been actually undertaken and carried out by people purporting to do it in the name of Islam, you can call it a phobia, right? So people are genuinely concerned. But all that's playing out now with Tommy Robinson and others and all the rest of it, it's no surprise to me, Ian. It's no surprise to me at all because I've been writing about this for 30 years. In fact, the first time I ever gave an interview on the increase in Islamist radicalization in this country was when I was a student at the London School of Economics to Newsnight in the mid-1990s, saying that these guys were trying to infiltrate, members of an Islamist group were trying to infiltrate our university. And we weren't having it. We're social scientists. We don't believe in black and white thinking. We told them to get lost and they went down the road to SOAS, where they did much better there. But it really concerns me. So everything playing out now, not a surprise. I'm deeply concerned. And I just think, you know, there is a role to play. There is a role to be played here. And I think I can do it as a broadcaster.
Well, I don't think you can.
Go on.
Because I think that you have to look at the words of Teddy Roosevelt, who said you have to be in the arena to change things. Now, you and I are in the arena of influence, and I think I can influence things from the margins, but I can't actually change anything because I do think you have to be a politician to effect change. And with all sorts of examples that we can give about individual politicians who've made that difference. And we can sit in front of our microphone and spout off about this, that or the other. We might even say things that when there are politicians listening that might maybe change their opinion at the margins. But we can't actually pull the levers of power.
Yes, but you're right. But power now is dissipating from the centre. And if you look at people who...
Is it really?
Well, yes and no, Ian. You're right in the sense that I completely agree with you, that the most direct lever to pull is to pull the lever of power where you can actually run things and effect change. Yes. However, does that mean the rest of us are powerless? Absolutely not. I'll give you an example. I founded a prize, as you know, for people in British public life that challenge the orthodoxy and go against the grain and take on the status quo. The last winner of my prize is not a politician. She's a lady who stood up against the systematic abuse on an industrial scale of young white girls, largely by gangs of Pakistani men in the northern towns of this country. Her name's Maggie Oliver. She's not a politician. Now, you just look at that. You look at people like Peter Tatchell, right? Never elected to anything. Has had a massive impact on gay rights and human rights in general in this country. You look at people like Michael Woodford, who won my prize, who was the first ever CEO in history to blow the whistle on his own company, Olympus Corporation, for a $1.8 billion fraud. So I think we have agency. Yes, you're right that the most direct way of effecting change is to be in power, to be in parliament, to be in the cabinet, to be a minister. Yes, I agree with you. But that does not mean the rest of us are powerless. In fact, I think the most important thing right now, the most pressing thing right now, is the level of discourse is basically in the gutter. It's just in the gutter. So what we try and do, and I know you do this very much on your programs too, is we try and elevate that discourse. We try and open up the space for people with different views to come in and have a robust, humorous, you know, sometimes rumbustious discussion where we try and learn from each other and advance something.
I agree with a lot of that, but do you not think that in the last few years we've also become part of the problem, in that because largely influenced by social media, it's very difficult to have a nuanced debate anymore. It has to be black or white. Yep. It has to be shouty a bit. And it frustrates me sometimes, in a way that it didn't 7 or 8 years ago, that because, I mean, we are judged by our audience figures. And if the audience figures decline quarter on quarter, well, we all know what the end result of that is. So you have to play the game a bit. But I'd still want to do my hour on the war in Congo from time to time.
Which you do. And I thoroughly enjoyed the hours that you do on these things. I mean, there was 1 hour you did. I remember it distinctly. I remember many of your hours. But you actually interviewed, I think, the US ambassador about her life and what she did and what an ambassador did. And I was like, making food in the kitchen. I thought, this is really very interesting. I didn't know what she did day to day. This is fascinating.
Yeah, there is a risk to this, though, isn't there? In that I know that I'm not a normal person. My interests are not normal.
I'll be
a bit careful how I put that, but you know what I mean.
I do.
What fascinates me about the world of politics doesn't necessarily fascinate Mrs. Miggins at 32 Acacia Avenue. So there is a balance to
strike here.
But I think that balance is, the Overton window of this balance is changing, isn't it?
But you know, you're right. The Overton window is changing. And yes, you're talking about we're part of the problem. We have to be shouty. My view on this is pretty straightforward, which is this. Look, in the programmes that we do, we set up a debate, right? So the first 10, 11 minutes, we're giving our opinion, we're doing a monologue, we're interviewing someone. And I think it's quite important, in most cases, I have pretty strong views on a lot of things, to put your view out there very clearly and succinctly for the audience. Very clearly. I don't sit on the fence typically, unless I genuinely am unclear about something or I haven't made up my mind, which occasionally can happen. I'm a human being. I have a view on everything. I have a view on a lot of things, but not on every single thing. But most of the time, I'll put out my view strongly, and people will then come in and you invite them in the conversation, and they'll either agree with you or disagree with you. And in fact, it's a bit like what Hegel said, right? So you've got the thesis, an antithesis, and then you form a synthesis, right? So Karl Popper said the same thing. Only through argumentation and disputation is progress made. I mean, if everyone's just going to be putting out their own view, not listening to others, not trying to nuance their own argument, I mean, heaven forbid you, A, might learn something from someone.
Well, quite.
Or you might actually improve your argument because someone's actually challenged you in a way you didn't think. And you think, actually, no, I'm still going to adopt my argument, but I'm actually going to twist it slightly and make it stronger. We shouldn't be fearful of proper, robust discourse. It should be robust. It doesn't have to be angry and abusive, which too much of this online nonsense is. And that's why I think our station does that well, because there is no scope for abuse. I mean, people are going to be abusive. You're just going to cut them off. I do have occasionally people who come on and just want to fight with me. And that happens, right? And you just call them out and say, you just want to fight. And then one guy did it the other day. I said, you just come on to have a fight with me. Come on, be honest. You just want to fight with me. He goes, Ali, I'm so sorry. Maybe I was a bit too much. And then he just went back to normal, made his point, and it was fine.
Mm. I mean, that's the greatest thing about LBC. As you said right at the beginning, I think I wrote the phrase in my book, so we provide the sausage, the callers provide the sizzle.
They are.
And I mean, you broadcast from Leicester Square.
Yes.
I'm broadcasting from Millbank. So it's all in vision. It's all live streamed. And that has changed things. And I'm sure that in time, every programme will be live streamed.
Absolutely.
But it does change the dynamic.
It does change the dynamic.
You know you're in vision. You can't do a wanker sign to your producer when they say something stupid in your ear. Not that Corey ever does, obviously. And you find that you have to do a little bit of ham acting. So when you make a point, you're gesticulating because you know you're on camera. So you become a slightly exaggerated version of yourself.
You know, the toughest thing I find, you're right about all of it, Ian. And I think also in some cases you can lose that intimacy you have with your callers, right? You can lose that intimacy. But look, it's a visual world now. We're competing against new media. We're competing against platforms like YouTube and TikTok and other things. And in fact, we're using those platforms for our own content, right? Because a lot of people who know of LBC now, particularly younger listeners, won't be listening to a 3-hour radio show from 7 till 10 or from 12 till 3 or whatever. They'll be watching clips and they'll say, oh, I saw you on YouTube. And, and that's how they take it in. So we have to move with the times. The toughest thing I find about when I cover your show sometimes is the in-ear headphones. I love the headphones because, you know, I'm a DJ, right? I love big headphones around my ears, right? I find that difficult. But it's got its own charm because, you know, you're effectively running a TV program in a way, although it is still a radio show.
How do you balance it? Because you are, I mean, you've got a challenging job.
Yeah,
I mean, I think you've just got a new job.
Yeah, I do. It's very demanding.
In the city.
Very demanding.
So you're doing that 5 days a week.
Yeah.
And then you're doing your 2-3-hour shows at the weekend.
Yeah.
How do you fit it all in?
With great difficulty. I mean, it's tough. Look, it's not easy. And I was told by a coach the other day, I was doing some burpees in the middle of a field in parts of
what?
You know these things where you do the army, you literally go down and do these press ups and put your kick your legs out and then do a star jump. Burpees, they do them in the SAS and stuff. Anyway,
thank God I've never heard of the word.
No. So he basically drew a quadrant and said, look, this is the high performance zone in the top right. In the bottom right, you have the recovery zone when you're meant to be sleeping, you're meant to be relaxing, you're meant to be doing some exercise, and in the left you have the survival zone in the top left and the burnout zone in the bottom right. And I think, in the bottom left, this isn't good. I think I'm in survival and burnout. And you have to be conscious about it and you have to carve out time for relaxation and moments, right? So I don't have the luxury of having days and weekends off because my shows are very important to me and I feel that it's a privilege to be on what I think is one of the premier station out there doing this stuff. And it's a great honor. So I'm very grateful for it. And I enjoy it very much. I have to find moments. I love the countryside. A big part of my life is going to the countryside. Difficult to do when you're finishing at 3. But I go on holidays. I do that. I also find solace in music as well. Particularly house music, that is a great passion of mine.
We'll come on to that.
Yeah, it is difficult to juggle. I'm not going to lie and say it's not easy to do. It's not, because I have a very demanding job in the city. I love the city. It's a core part of my DNA. Banking is key. And I think, you know, you have to try and juggle it all. It is not easy, but if you want to do something in life, you find a way of making it work. And as I say, I'm always very conscious that people would give their right arm to have the opportunity that I've been given, right? And you have to be conscious of that and respectful of it, right? Because, look, Ian, look, let's be honest about it. There are 20 seats at LBC. And in prime time, in the daytime, there are probably like 8, 9. It's like being in a Formula One team, right? That is the truth. So if you're lucky enough to have been given that opportunity, I mean, you've got to grasp it with both hands. You've got to make it work.
I'm Professor Noel Fitzpatrick, and as a vet, I know you want the best care for your animal companion. Pet insurance can help, but you need to choose wisely, as not all policies are the same. PetPlan aim to pay claims quickly and without a fuss, and that's one reason why so many vets work with them.
Get your pet the best veterinary care. Save 10% on new policies when you insure at petplan.co.uk. T's and C's apply. Fitz All Media is an appointed representative of PetPlan Limited.
Stuck waiting again.
Tell me about it. I've spent all morning trying to get through to my GP.
Oh, I ditched that stress and joined Benenden Health. They've got 24/7 GP helpline. No waiting rooms, no sitting around.
Really? Sounds like a great service, unlike this one.
Keep your week on track with a 24/7 GP helpline and much more. All for less than £16 per person per month. Search Benenden Health.
Fee reviewed periodically. T's and C's apply. Qualifying periods apply for some services. UK only. Visit benenden.co.uk.
What are your ambitions? I'm not just talking about in broadcasting, but more generally, because I'm listening to you talk. I mean, you clearly love doing the shows.
Yes, I do.
When I started in 2010, I assumed that I would get a weekend show.
Yeah. I remember your weekend show. Your Sunday shows are brilliant.
Well, but they came a little bit later.
Yeah.
But they said, no, we want you to do the evening show 5 days a week. Yeah. And I already had a full-time job 5 days a week. And I remember the day after this conversation, the then managing editor, Jonathan Richards, phoned me up. He said, you didn't seem very excited about the prospects. And I said, no, I really am. It's what I've always wanted to do. But I'm trying to think, how do I juggle a full-time job with a second full-time job? And I mean, I suppose what I'm getting at is if Tom Cheel came to you tomorrow and said, you know that Ian Dale, I think we've had enough of him. So he's going to be leaving in a couple of months. I know, it will at some point. He's going to be leaving in a couple of months. How do you fancy taking over? I mean, would you have a choice to make then? Or would you think, well, no, I'm actually quite happy doing it as I'm doing it at the moment?
I think there would be a choice to make, and there are choices always to make in life, and you come to moments where you have to pick a fork in the road, and your balance shifts. Look, this, three things have always been fundamentally important in my life, or running concurrently in my life, all the way through, actually. Professional career in finance and banking. Also, initially politics, and now media, broadcasting, and house music. All of those have been running concurrently, and all of them have been done, I think, hopefully, to a pretty decent standard, right? This is not like your dilettante DJ or your... I mean, you're doing it, you're working hard at it, and you're trying to excel in those fields. The focus shifts from time to time, right? So the city is a massively important part of my life. I'm also going to become, hopefully, master of the Worshipful Company of International Bankers Livery Company. That's a big thing, a big city job, and I'm very privileged to be able to do that. So that's important. But look, to answer your question directly, if the ball were to come loose from the back of the scrum, one would have to have a conversation about it, right? And the first question I would ask is, Tom, if that were to come up, is how much are you paying? Now, come on, I'm joking. You know I'm joking. But you look, you don't know what's going to happen in life. You have to look at things in the round. Sometimes your focus has to shift depending on where you are and what you want to achieve. And I really do think that, as I say, being part of the conversation, challenging people respectfully, trying to move the debate on, trying to discuss some of the most pressing, difficult issues of the day, be that what do we do about the job losses that are going to come from AI? What do we deal with an aging population? What do we deal about youth unemployment? What do we deal about increasing polarization in our society and rising tensions with the rise of the right, which is no surprise to me, right? All of these things, I think, require proper discussion. So who knows what will happen? We'll have to have that conversation at the time.
And you get very good audience figures, don't you? I mean, we all... This is what people in the BBC never... Yes. I don't think BBC presenters are even told what their audience figures are.
We live and die by it.
We do. And weekends, I think in any radio station, tends to be quite challenging.
Yes.
If you can get a good radar card at a weekend, you know that you're going to have a good overall card. And you certainly have. And, I mean, you took over this slot. Shall we say, how can I put this diplomatically, at a slightly difficult time?
Yes.
Without going into all the whys and wherefores of that. And you built that audience through the power of your own personality, I think. And, I mean, how aware were you that this was a bit of a critical moment?
I mean, look, when you're given the opportunity, and I was actually cover presenting on the weekends in the afternoons. I think I was doing the 2 till 5 slot, something like that, or 3 till 6, whatever it was. I was doing that for quite a while, and then there were always changes in the station and these things. But when the offer was made to do your own show, in prime time, on a Saturday and Sunday. I mean, this is something that, you know, this is what you dream of. I mean, you literally dream of. Mm. And you just think, this doesn't happen. This is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity on the station I've been listening to for decades. Decades. I mean, I was listening to your show right from the start, right? I mean, these are people like Nick and James and you and others who you look up to, right? You look up to them as broadcasters. I mean, look, why I'm so passionate about broadcasting, Ian. Look, I was brought up with people like Jeremy Paxman, John Humphreys, Brian Walden, real heavyweight broadcasters. And you think, you want to bring a bit of that into your thing. So it was never in any doubt that I would grasp that opportunity with both hands and try and do the best I can. And when you talk about audience figures, look, the figures are what they are. What I try and do is to try and be authentic, try and put my voice out there, try and put my opinion out there. Yes, I'm quite, can be a little bit provocative and also quite robust in my views, but also, I believe, respectful to others who disagree with me, right? And we also have a bit of fun. We poke fun at each other a little bit with the callers and stuff. And it's all done in good humour and with respect. And I think that's what people want to listen to. And a lot of people are, let's be honest, ferrying their kids around to rugby or cricket on a Saturday, putting it on in the car. Some people are cooking. In fact, my mother was in hospital, sadly, for the last week or so. And I was going to see her every day. And the woman, there was a very nice lady in the next bed to my mother, and her daughter was coming to see her every day as well. And on the first day, she said to me, I'm so sorry to ask you this, but I think I know you from the radio. And I said, really? She goes, yeah, you're Ali Mirage, aren't you? I said, yeah, how do you know? She goes, your voice.
Yeah.
People can recognize your voice. It happened to me the other day. I was going to a breakfast meeting at Rothschild's Bank, and there was a lift attendant. They still have a lift attendant at Rothschild's, right? Old school. And I said, good morning. She says, you're Ali Mirage. I said, how do you know? She goes, I listen to your show. I recognize your voice.
And they can do it within a couple of words. Yeah. It's usually with me, it happens in taxis.
Exactly.
I say, Leicester Square, you're that Ian Dale, aren't you? Or sometimes, you're that James O'Brien, aren't you?
No, it's good.
But it's a weird phenomenon, isn't it, to be recognised, yes. Particularly if it's just by your voice.
But Ian, we have such a privilege doing this. Such a privilege. Genuinely, we have a privilege. And I respect the fact that I've been given this opportunity and it can be taken away any time. I mean, your figures are what they are, right? So it may not be forever. Who knows? So you've got to grasp it while you have. Do the best you can. And hopefully the listeners respond.
Well, you've always got your decks to fall back on, haven't you? Let's have a word about your DJ interest. Because you are not a typical DJ.
No.
How'd you get into it?
I got into it because I used to be I trained as a chartered accountant initially. And one of my main clients was the Ministry of Sound, run by a guy called James Palumbo at the time. And I used to be going to ministry during the middle of my accountancy exams, which were very difficult. You're working, you're doing these exams, you're managing staff. Really, really tough. I mean, that was probably the toughest of my professional career. I mean, banking is tough, but that was a different level. You can do that, you can do anything. And I remember having to go to ministry every Saturday night, pretty much, to obviously get an understanding of my client, inverted commas, but to basically survive. It was my release. It was my outlet. And over there, during the late 90s, I was meeting some of the biggest DJs in the world. So David Morales, Dennis Ferrer, all these guys. And one person really had a massive, profound effect on me, and that was Frankie Knuckles. He's the godfather of house. He invented house music in Chicago in the 1980s.
Oh, I thought he was one of the Krays.
Not one of the Krays. But no, Frankie Knuckles was a huge influence on me, and I remember him descending from, we call it the box in ministry, the main room where they play, and he descended, and I said, Frankie, I audit Ministry of Sound. I'd love to talk to you. And he called me. And I said, Frankie, I just find you inspirational. And I remember the first time I ever saw him before I met him at ministry was at the terrace at Space in Ibiza, when I walked in and he was playing this song, which was a remix by Full Intention, who are some producers who remixed Brandy's Full Moon. It's an amazing song. And it was at the terrace at Space at 3 o'clock on a Sunday afternoon. And Frankie was playing and I was just hooked. I was hooked on this. And then I remember telling my mother that, look, my mum's a doctor, right? Very traditional family. I said, look, I want to be a DJ. Like any good Pakistani mother, she said to me, that's absolutely fine. Just make sure you get a qualification in it.
Do you know, a conversation is coming back to me that I had with Aisha Hazarika once, who did present on LBC. She's on Times Radio now.
Yes.
And she says that she is the biggest disappointment to her parents because she never, she's an Asian Muslim, and she said they just wanted me to be a doctor or
that's
an accountant.
That's right, that's right, that's right.
Well, you have got an accountancy qualification, but you've been able to do other things
that's
as well.
That's true, yeah. So I went to DJ school. I went to a place called Point Blank in Hoxton, which is like the Harvard of DJ schools, qualified, did my thing, and then I started DJing. And my first ever gig was actually when I was standing for Parliament in Watford. And I'd gone literally from DJing in my bedroom to DJing in this club called Area in the main room on a Saturday night in front of 600 people, warming up for a guy called Mark Knight from Tool Room Records, who's like a big figure. And I was playing on three decks in the main room, and I had the bar staff dancing. And Frankie Knuckles always told me, Ali, play to the person at the back of the room. Play to the lady at the back of the room who's not dancing. You got to make her dance.
Yeah, but it's so simple. You just put on Dancing Queen.
Well, I'd have to play a house remix of Dancing Queen. I've got some respect to maintain, particularly in Shoreditch in the dance music scene. But look, you can music and house music in particular to me is just... It's a big part of my life, but, and you connect with people in a different way.
I'm going to sound terrible. I'm going to sound like that judge in the Not the 9 o'clock News sketch. Is that a popular music beat combo? I mean, house music. Yes. I couldn't tell you what it is, or give me three famous artists that I would have heard
of. Well, you might have heard of Disclosure. You might have heard of David Morales. I don't know if you've heard of David Morales. I'm not sure if you've heard. Well, who else have you could have heard? You've heard of Fred Again? Have you heard of Fred Again? Okay, but all these are contemporary artists.
How is it different to trance music? Because I like trance music.
Trance is a bit more progressive, and it's a bit it's faster and it's a bit dreamier. House is really a four to the floor. We call it four to the floor beat. So the beat is one, two, three, four. And the reason why this whole genre developed was because there were two guys behind it. Frankie Knuckles in Chicago and Larry Levan in New York in the late 1980s were playing disco in these clubs.
Yeah.
And effectively, they were playing with a Roland drum machine behind it, pumping out these beats. And people then used to go to these record stores saying, I want to buy the music they play at the Warehouse Club. And that became house. That's how it started. So, yeah, look, it's been a huge part of my life. And you will hear house music in any club, in any bar you go to, on adverts. It's everywhere. It's basically taken over the world.
And yeah, I mean, look,
You would recognize any dance track you hear. It typically will have a four to the floor beat, and that is the roots of it. A house, they're all house.
Anything that we haven't covered that you think we should have covered?
No, Ian. I look at the world now, and I look at the UK now, and I do worry. I genuinely worry about where we are. You know, I mean, I mentioned it before, the rise of the right, all across Europe, the rise of the right here. And, you know, people use the term right quite liberally. And I think you've got to be careful about that because not everyone's hard right, not everyone's
extreme. But you're accused of being hard right.
I'm accused of being hard right, right? Because I talk about these issues and I'm accused of being hard right. And I just think to myself, look, when I was standing for Parliament in Watford, the penny dropped. It was probably in 2004 in Garston in Watford when I was talking to some lady who was washing her car in a local election. And I said, how are you going to vote? And she said, I'm going to vote BNP. I said, why is that? And she said, I want my country back. That was 2004. And that was when we had immigration at 150,000 net per year, right? It then went up to 300,000 odd when we had the referendum to leave the EU, and then it trebled to 900,000. People are fed up of this nonsense. They're fed up of it. Successive politicians of different political hues have not delivered on this. And we are now seeing the consequences of it. You've got to... Democracy only works if politicians respond to the will of the people. You can't persistently have a situation where people vote for one thing, whether you like it or not, and you consistently ignore them, even if you think it's the wrong thing to do. People vote. That is what democracy is. And it's little wonder, therefore, that we're in this position now. And it does worry me deeply because none of this is a surprise to me. Now, where do we go from here? What do we do about it? Well, I think the first thing is to try and get a grip of the issue. And I think, you know, to be her credit at the moment, I think Shabana Mahmood, the Labour Home Secretary, has got the good idea on that particular point. But more deeply, we need to understand some of the angst and some of the anxiety that people have, particularly around Islam. And I'm a Muslim, right? I care about my religion deeply. But when I see people, for example, praying in Trafalgar Square, right? I'm thinking to myself, just because you can do something doesn't mean you should do something, right? I mean, why are you trying to freak out some poor granny in Pateley Bridge, right, who's having a Victoria sponge by praying in Trafalgar? Why do that, right? I mean, you don't need to. This is the most liberal, open, free country to be a person of any religion at all. Why do that? The PR, honestly, sometimes is terrible, and it doesn't help the situation, and it doesn't help the polarization that we have that's getting worse and worse and worse, right? The tensions are rising, and it's going to get even worse. So we've got a chance to pull it back. We've got to be mindful about it, and we can't keep just saying, no, we're going to consistently do what we've always done and hope for a different result. It's just not going to happen. So I do worry about that deeply, and then obviously I worry about other things like the traditional stuff like growth and this and that and productivity and how we get this country actually motoring again. Because when I look at Britain on the international stage, I think this is a phenomenal country, talented. Brain power in this country is absolutely gargantuan. But we need to unleash it. We need to do stuff. We need to invest. We need to, yes, reindustrialize. We need to focus on what we're good at, lean into what we're good at, and actually have a vision of how to run this country properly. And we've been really let down with some very poor governance, lack of vision, that the electoral cycle doesn't help. So there are big, big things I worry about, Ian, and give me sleepless nights. But I tell you, the polarization element is one of them. It really is.
Ali Mirage, thank you very much for joining us on All Talk. And if you've enjoyed this episode, and I'm sure you have, do leave a positive review wherever you get your podcast from. And join us again next week for another edition of Ian Dale All Talk. Goodbye.
This has been a global production.
When back or joint pain hits, hit back hard. With Neuromol Dual Action Pain Relief. Combining the power of ibuprofen and paracetamol to deliver faster, longer-lasting, more effective pain relief than regular painkillers alone. Get tough on pain with Neuromol Dual Action Pain Relief. Regular painkillers are paracetamol or ibuprofen. Neuromol Dual Action Pain Relief tablets for pain not relieved by ibuprofen or paracetamol individually. Always read the label.
Virgin Media Sports Bundles. Yeah. They're for the fans, including Sky Sports HD, F1, Netflix, Sky Atlantic, and ultra-fast broadband. That's stacks of football, tennis, and cricket, and plenty of racing too. All for great low prices. Yeah, low, low. Visit virginmedia.com.
New customers only. Virgin Fiber areas. Restrictions and credit checks apply. Netflix terms of use apply. Terms apply.